You are about to hear two responses to the Canada Oceans Lecture 2008 delivered by Dr. Jeff Hutchings of Dalhousie University on October 22nd. That is followed by questions and answers from a well-informed audience. Dr. Hutchings is chair of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, COSWIC. That's the National Science Advisory Body responsible for advising the Federal Minister of the Environment on the status of species at risk in Canada. His news about our declining fisheries and our failed management strategies was sobering. The respondents are Jamie Alley, Director of the Oceans and Marine Fisheries Division, BC Ministry of the Environment, that's British Columbia, and Dr. Daniel Pauly, Director of the Fisheries Centre at the University of British Columbia. The original lecture by Dr. Hutchings is available as a free MP3 download from www.ecoshock.org. Look for Oceans in our Audio On Demand menu. My thanks to Dr. Hutchings and Simon Fraser University for making this recording available for nonprofit radio. The event was at the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue on October 22, 2008.
So let's turn now to our two respondents. First of all, Jamie Alley is the Director of Ocean. Do you want to stand up so we know who you are? Great. Is the Director of Oceans and Marine Fisheries Division with the BC Ministry of the Environment. He's a geographer by training with degrees in resource management from Simon Fraser University and the University of Victoria, and he specializes in coastal zone management. He began his career with the BC provincial government in 1977 and has held a variety of policy and program positions in natural resource ministries, as well as the Intergovernmental Relations Secretariat and the Cabinet Office. From 1998 until 2002, he was the Director of Freshwater Fisheries Management, and from 2002 to 2004, he worked on establishing the Living Rivers Program and the Trust Fund associated with it. He's currently the Director of the Oceans and Marine Fisheries Branch in the Ministry of the Environment and has responsibility for the provincial government's interests in marine fisheries management, seafood industry development, and oceans resource management. He's the co-chair of the National Oceans Task Group under the Canadian Council of Fisheries and Aquaculture Ministers, the Canada-BC Oceans Coordinating Committee, and the BC-Washington Coastal and Oceans Task Force, and is a member of the West Coast Vancouver Island Aquatic Management Board. Our second respondent, I'll introduce both of them first, and then we'll move to their comments, is Daniel Pauly. Daniel, could you let us recognize you? Thanks. I'm sure many people in the room also know you. Daniel is the director of the Fisheries Center at UBC, University of British Columbia. And in fact, I was saying to him before how much I've enjoyed reading his newsletter over many years. For some reason, it was directed to my desk, and I found it a fascinating update on what was going on. He joined UBC in 1994 after many years at the International Center for Living Aquatic Resource Management in Manila, the Philippines. His scientific output, mainly dedicated to management of fisheries and to ecosystem modeling, comprises numerous contributions to peer-reviewed journals, authored and edited books, reports and popular articles, and the concepts, methods, and software that he co-developed are in use throughout the world. In 2001, he was awarded the Vancouver Aquarium Murray Newman Award for Excellence in Marine Conservation Research and the Oscar E. Setti Award of the Marine Fisheries Section of the American Fisheries Society. He was named an honorary professor at Keele University in the late 2002, and in 2003 he was named as one of the University of British Columbia's Distinguished University Scholars and was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. In 2004, he received the Roger Revelle Medal from IOC UNESCO and the Award of Excellence of the American Fisheries Society. So it's a great pleasure to introduce these two experts, and I think we will start with comments from Jamie. Do you want to come to the main mic?
Thank you very much. I'm not sure if I was asked to be a respondent because I was one of the sponsors, and so I paid to get my opportunity to speak, but certainly the BC provincial government was very pleased to have the opportunity to be one of the sponsors to this, and thank you very much, Jeff, for that tremendously stimulating lecture. Some of you might be wondering, why is somebody from the provincial government here rather than the federal government, in that we have no constitutional jurisdictional responsibility for oceans and fisheries? The simple answer is that while the province may not have constitutional responsibilities, we care deeply about it. And so my job in particular is one of influencing the manner in which DFO, the federal government, manages commercial and recreational marine fisheries, responsibility for the development of the seafood industry. Once a fish is caught and becomes property, it actually is under provincial jurisdiction. And we care very deeply about what happens next with that fish, because that will determine the economic and social and community benefits that flow from that. And I also have responsibility for oceans management. And this leads me really to, I wanted to comment on a couple of things. One is in the area of governance. One in the area of, or perhaps a few comments in terms of reforming fisheries and fisheries management, and then some thoughts that I might have about how we untangle some of these things. In the area of governance, I'm going to take a slightly different tact on this. When I took over as the national co-chair of the Oceans Task Group on behalf of the other provinces and territories, it was in September of 2005, and the Parliamentary Commissioner on Sustainability had just finished their review of the first 8 years of the Oceans Act and the progress made, or the lack of progress. And the report was pretty devastating in terms of the lack of progress. And Larry Murray, who was the deputy of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans at the time, came to give us all a pep talk. And Larry said a couple things that really, really kind of struck me. He said, first of all, I feel that we have fundamentally failed to develop the governance structures that we need to be successful. And then he said, we failed to reach out and develop the partnerships that we needed to have with other orders of government and the Canadian public. And he said, we failed to put oceans in the top 10 list of the public policy hit parade. He said, when DFO defines partnerships, and I can tell a story that sounds critical of DFO because they're telling it about themselves, he said, the way that we define partnerships is we find an area of our business that we can't afford to do anymore. We look around for somebody else to do it. We get them to do it. Then we make them pay for it. And so what we've been working on the National Oceans Task Group then is looking at different ways of changing the nature of the governance structure. So the argument that we make in terms of the provincial perspective is that both under the Fisheries Act and under the Oceans Act, we've been running under the kind of assumption that those are areas of exclusive federal jurisdiction. Whereas what you find, and Gordon Slade and I were talking about this at dinner, is that in both fisheries and oceans management, you find many areas of exclusive federal jurisdiction, many areas of exclusive provincial jurisdiction, many areas of shared jurisdiction, many areas of uncertain jurisdiction, and many areas of evolving jurisdiction. So many people are now talking about how do we untangle this and do the right thing. In the BC provincial government, we often talk about the dirt side of government, which is the natural resource ministries, and the social side of government. And we on the dirt side of government don't think we can learn anything from the social side of government. Recently, on the social side of government, there's been a bit of a revolution sweeping around there. And it's based on something that they call the Jordan Principle. And this stemmed from a fairly tragic story of a young First Nations boy named Jordan who was seriously ill. And while the federal and provincial governments were arguing over which one was going to be responsible for Jordan's medical care, he died. And so the Jordan Principle is we shall never let any more the jurisdictional uncertainties stop us from doing the right thing. So I think we on the dirt side of government and in fisheries and oceans management may need to start having a serious look. So we've been talking at some of the lessons learned from the Jordan Principle. So we've been talking about how do you move from that traditional government of a single agency and a single responsibility to shared governance kinds of arrangements. And you can move through traditional government to consultation, to shared learning, to devolved decision-making, to cooperative management, to structured decision-making, to shared decision-making. So what we're beginning to find now is as we are shifting the way that we manage fisheries, those fisheries that have collaborative governance kinds of arrangements tend to have the attributes of better managed fisheries. They tend to be more economically profitable. The biomass tends to be more stable. The benefits from the fishery tend to be shared much more equitably amongst the communities. And so when the provincial government issued its great goals for the Golden Decade, one of the targets that the Premier set for us was that we wanted to be known by best fisheries management, bar none. So we began to have to try and grapple with, well, what does best fisheries management, bar none, mean? Now, when I was the director of freshwater fisheries, that was something that was actually relatively simple. We didn't have a commercial fishery to speak of that I had to deal with. 50% of the angling activity was on stocked lakes, so whenever you had a problem, you could just crack up the hatcheries and dump a few more trout in the lake. We had very collaborative management processes with some of our primary stakeholders. If a particular trout lake wasn't fishing very well, the local rod and gun club would come in and say, would you put that lake onto catch and release for a couple of years until the stocks come back, and that's what we would do. On steelhead management, though, Jeff, we are moving in that direction of setting target reference points and target limit points, and Daniel can talk much better than I can on that side. But in addition to the collaborative decision-making, we also are looking at different ways that you can reform the way that the fishery is actually conducted. And there are a couple of good examples that we have in British Columbia the last few years where some of that is beginning to happen. We're now in year three of the pilot of the integration of all of our groundfish fisheries. And we were quite encouraged recently that when World Wildlife Fund and Environmental Defense Fund wanted to have the Mexicans come and see what they considered to be the best fisheries management, they brought a delegation of four Mexican governors and the equivalent of the Mexican Minister of Fisheries to come and look at the integrated groundfish fishery pilot here in BC, and there's lots more information on that. So it is encouraging, though, that you can reform a fishery that before had some attributes that that were of great concern and change the nature of it. I did want to pick up on Jeff's comments in terms of Marine Stewardship Council certification. Many people may not know this, but British Columbia has been the kind of pusher and driver behind this nationally. It was at BC's insistence a year and a half ago that the Canadian Council of Fisheries and Aquaculture Ministers made a national commitment to Marine Council Stewardship certification. One of the things Jeff didn't say was that the MSC is the only third-party certification process that is compliant with FAO guidelines. There's lots of mail-order certification fisheries out there. We get letters in the mail all the time that say, send us $1,000 and you can become a friend of the sea or whatever and have your fishery certified. MSC is a very rigorous third-party fishery that looks at three things. It looks at the state of your stocks. It looks at the impacts of your harvesting methods on the marine ecosystem, and it looks at your governance capacity. We now have six of BC's fisheries in the full certification process right now, sockeye salmon, pink and chum, hake, halibut, and dogfish. There are another nine BC fisheries that are in the confidential pre-assessment phase. And once all these fisheries are in, those will represent about 93% of the commercial harvest in within British Columbia. So we see the MSC process as a way of demonstrating to the world the sustainable management of our fisheries. I think it's also critical that we get at the right drivers of ecological change. And I think Jeff has really done a good job of that, of talking about the impacts of climate change. For many years, I think a lot of the salmon managers within BC perceived that the ocean was some big steady state out there and we could just pop smolts out there, and they would be nourished by the ocean. And we have seen smolt to adult return rates plummet from as high as 15% in the 80s to less than 1% today. Now, whether or not this is just an oscillation that will return to higher productivity levels, or if this is a permanent shift, is probably the most worrisome thing. But there are reasons to think that we at least can respond and that we have the science now that lets us monitor some of these things. This year, we saw a really bad sockeye year, some of the lowest sockeye returns that we've had. But we knew that back in when the fish that spawned in 2004 went to sea in 2005, that they went into a very warm ocean that had very, very little productivity and very, very little food. So we knew that 2008 was going to be a tough year. And both DFO and ourselves have been preparing people for that tough year since 2005. We warned our customers that there wouldn't be much of a sockeye pack this year. DFO began a process of dialogue with First Nations up and down the Fraser, and there was an unprecedented catch sharing agreements amongst the First Nations for the fish that did come back and for their food, social, and ceremonial fisheries. And as a result, we got back onto the spawning grounds. The target escapements that we wanted to have. So the lesson there is that a lot of people might look at the 2008 sockeye fishery and say, well, this is a failure of fisheries management, but you can also turn that around and say, look, this is a good, successful case of good fisheries management where we knew that it was going to be a bad year when we saw those smolts go out to sea, and we ratcheted the fishery down and we didn't fish it. Now, on a note of optimism, I am told that the escapements of many runs in 2006, the smolts that went to sea then, were some of the highest on record, and those fish went to a much colder and hopefully more productive ocean. So let's keep our fingers crossed next year, because maybe we will see much higher returns coming back to the coast. But it still speaks to the question that Jeff was bringing about is, has there something gone on with the ocean as a result of climate change where no matter what we do here, we still may not see the level of returns that we've had back in the past? And that really speaks to the need to reform the nature of the way that we harvest fish. So we're beginning to talk about how do we shift from high-volume, low-value fisheries to lower-volume, higher-value fisheries that put more benefits back into those communities that are continuing to fish. I think the last point, Jeff, that I'd like to pick up on is the whole question of oceans literacy. We, as British Columbians, I think, undervalue our fisheries. I've heard it said that British Columbians have forgotten that we're an oceans and coastal people. When we think of ourselves, we tend to turn and look at the mountains and we look at the trees. And if we think of the oceans at all, we think of salmon, and then we get a queasy feeling because of the bad stories that people have told us about salmon. So I think British Columbians need to reaffirm and restore their sense of themselves as a coastal people. Well, how do we do that? Last year, we undertook with DFO the first ever study of what our ocean's economy is. And it was quite shocking what we found. It was twice as large as we thought it was and much more diverse than we thought it was, and represents somewhere between 9 and 10% of the GDP of the province. That's the pure economic value. But we also began to do some work on what are some of the non-market values. So these studies are now posted on our website, and they're there. But it doesn't get at the question of oceans literacy. So the provinces and territories were quite critical of the federal government on the Oceans Action Plan because we were not consulted in terms of some of the content. So after Oceans Action Plan Phase 1 came out in 2005, we began to prepare some work for the next phases of the Oceans Action Plan. British Columbia and the Pacific region of DFO volunteered to develop a proposal for an oceans literacy program to be included in the next phases of the ocean strategy. I was telling Gordon at dinner, my federal co-chair, after we had finished making the presentation, said, so I guess we're all agreed that's a kind of low to medium kind of priority. And I said, wait a minute, as the chair. And I said, I don't know, I think that's a high priority. And it was encouraging to note that all the other provinces and territories thought that that was a very high priority, and we've communicated that to the federal government. Because I think that that re-engagement of British Columbians, re-engagement of Canadians in oceans literacy is something that we really need to do. And British Columbia, from our perspective, will continue to push the federal government to include our proposals for an oceans literacy program in the next phases of the National Ocean Strategy. So I'll stop there. Jeff, thank you very much once again for your lecture, and I look forward to hearing some of the discussions from others this evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. I'll ask Daniel to come up.
Good evening. Now, you have been told that I've been here since 94. I'm very happy, and one of these next month I'm going to file in my application to become Canadian. That's going to be good. But I will emphasize the fact that I came as an adult to Canada as an outsider. And the first time I came to Canada actually was in 78 and 73. I'm that old, as a student. And I was based in Germany at the time. And I came with one of the giant vessels that, I came to New York, and then I went up the coast, and the first thing I bought in Canada was a hockey stick, because when I was a kid, the other kids always broke my stick, and I didn't have a proper stick. Anyway, I still have it. I bought a hockey stick, and I joined in Halifax, a German vessel that was surveying the coast of Labrador. And it was in the heyday of the foreign fleet. And they were catching at about, we were catching at about 500 meter depth, mountains of cod. They were thrown overboard because it was a vicious vessel. All we did is take the otoliths. And we lifted rocks as big as a Volkswagen with the trawlers. And at the time, there were no words to describe but the habitat modification that we were doing and the total lack of understanding of what we were doing. But we were doing it at an industrial scale, a gigantic scale. And one is not surprised that the whole thing came to a grinding halt, obviously. Now, I came next time to, in 94, I had been recruited by UBC, and one of the first, I had my family still in the Philippines at the time, I was going, that was a longer commute, actually. In one evening, I went to SFU. They had an invitation about celebration about cod, and this was a fisheries people, and the first time I met that. And there were lots of people talking about cod and about salmon and stuff, and I was listening. And there was a gentleman who proposed to toast Tobin. Now, Tobin, at the time, was still Minister of Fisheries, and he had gone after the dastardly Spaniards because they had been fishing, and there was enough confusion to believe that they had been the cause for the cod collapsing. There was enough confusion among the public to believe that. And the toast was going to be given to this Tobin. And then a gentleman, I don't know who it was. It might have been John Fraser, but he denies it. Anyway, a gentleman said, well, actually, I don't want to toast this guy because he did all the things that we in Canada do not like. He stirred up xenophobia. He stirred up prejudices against the Spaniard, against foreigners. He started a campaign to divert attention away from what the errors may do. He disinformed the public, and he was a demagogue. And this is not Canadian values. And the glass, which had already lifted, nobody wanted to. And I really was impressed by that. That was Canada and the nicest Canadians. And what essentially you have seen from Jeff's presentation is you're much too nice. You're being lied to. And you swallow it. Because these things that that the minister does against all evidence is lies. The justification that he presents, these are lies. And what we tell our children not to do, these are lying, right? But he does. So you are much too nice. And also, and I was wondering about these collapses and stuff, and not that they don't happen in Europe or they don't happen in anywhere in the world, but in Canada they happened in full knowledge of the fact because people were studying things and they knew, and still you saw this percent, you saw this increase of from 1% to 2% of the stock, and then you said it increased. So people in other places often don't have this data. They are here. Here you have them, and they can lie. And this caused me to step back a bit, and actually, and to understand why are you exporting so much stuff, and you essentially still have a colonial economy, largely the export of raw material. The comparison that one can do on the East Coast between the cod fishery in Canada and the cod fishery that the Spaniards, for example, conduct in, say, in Eastern Europe, in Europe. And I was also impressed by, or not impressed, by the smoking of sardine. They were so badly smoked. This was a bad product. This was mass production of bad fish for a market that was paying very little in the Caribbean. The Eastern Canada has never exported a quality product. It has exported a mass product. And it's also the case, so far I know, on this coast, where the salmon that is produced is actually sold cheap and is not really the top product. And this is a colonial economy, largely, and the export of trees and the export of gas, of fuel, sorry, of petrol from tar sands and enormous quantities with enormous environmental damage. That is the marks of a colonial economy, something that you would expect from, or post-colonial economy, something that you expect from Nigeria, but not from an advanced democracy. So the next step is thinking there is a deficit, a democratic deficit. How come somebody can lie like that? I didn't say it. Jeff said it. But we all know this is true. They lie. And how come they can get away and we re-elect them? We have a deficit, a democratic deficit. And that implies then that that other methods are used than every 3 or 4 years voting or not voting or whatever. That implies that the need for a civil engagement in NGOs that raise hell. Because clearly, they have decided that they would not listen in a channel that are foreseen for that. The scientists tell them the stuff, here it is, and then they say, I don't give a hoot. And that's it. So you have to raise hell. And raising hell, one cannot do that individually. There were anarchists 100 years ago to blow up bombs and stuff. That doesn't bring anything. So one has to be organized, an NGO, and raise hell through NGOs. I cannot say anything else, really. Without organized, articulated movements that raise hell, Minister Hans will continue to do his things, and his successor will do that, and the successor of his successor. And the parade of nonsense has gone on in full knowledge of everything, and it goes on and on. So that one has to say no to, and that can be only in the form of joining NGOs and raising hell. So let's raise hell together. Thank you very much.
So we have some time for either questions or comments. You know how the microphone system works. I will try to moderate by choosing a random selection of questioners from around the room. Could I just ask, in the interests of time and to give as many people as possible the chance to speak, that if you have a comment or a question, you make it as precisely as possible, and that will allow Dr. Hutchings to respond to that? Thanks. Right over there.
Yes, thank you. Wonderful presentation, and it's good to see that at least the province is here tonight. I don't know if there are any federal politicians. I'll preface my comments by saying that recently UBC-based political science by the name of Michael Byers responded to the Lament for a Nation with a book called Intent for a Nation. And at the book launch, I promised to read it. And I read the chapter on the Arctic and came home that night and found the Prime Minister announcing Canada's strategy for the Arctic right out of that chapter. It was a very moving moment, and I hope the Prime Minister steals some of your ideas tonight. That said, I was here a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about the seed vault in Norway and the massive collapse of diversity that came with agriculture and the storing of agricultural seeds to plan ahead. I don't think we have that capability with our marine species and land mammals, other than with musea and aquaria, which will not provide the same type of security into the future. The British Columbia, with only 18% of our coastline, has a remarkable emerging new knowledge that comes from the archaeological discoveries of First Nations practicing large-scale mariculture with native marine species, plants, fishes, and so forth. One question is, how can we rediscover that knowledge, step away from the agricultural mode, and look at stewardship modes? Even one individual, such as Alexandra Morton, has brought a case to BC Supreme Court asking that the feds take on the issue of managing fish farms, looking at the impacts of an agricultural model, an industrial leased zone model that our province has brought into play and is apparently potentially deeply causing harm to our fisheries. I attended the closing arguments and saw the province arguing against such measures. What I learned when I had a moment to speak with Ms. Morton, Alexandra Morton, the petitioner to the court, was one, the court only understands jurisdiction, and the legal arguments go to the common resource. We can breathe the air and return it. We can use the water and return it, but we can't own it. The one thing the courts don't understand is science. And I think neither do the politicians. So my question is, what lessons can we learn from the stunning knowledge that's emerging from our First Nations that can give us a future for our fisheries on all the coastlines of Canada, and for the province? And our land, our province has released data, satellite data and imagery of our land-based resources, but I think even into the public sphere, high-definition imagery, for example, to Google. But what will be done to release that data and information to the public with our oceans and our subsea floor? And when will we begin to move beyond an industrial model that treats everything like oil and gas leases and resource leases? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. I'm not quite sure how well qualified I am to respond in whole to what you say, but I'll just make a couple of quick comments with respect to much of what you're talking about and your comments on the side of aquaculture in British Columbia. It makes me think that that's probably, from a fisheries perspective, one of the best examples in this country of public participation and public involvement in a matter of importance, at least vis-a-vis the oceans. It's a very polarized issue, quite clearly. People fall across the spectrum, but at least there's public engagement. And I think even if at the end of the day decisions are to a greater or lesser degree what one might want to have happen, there is that engagement and that involvement, and that's something that is lacking in many, many other parts. And the only other comment I want to make, you mentioned the First Nations. I had the opportunity yesterday morning in Halifax before I flew here to speak to 27 Aboriginal elders from Quebec and the Maritimes on issues of species at risk. And one woman spoke to me, Mi'kmaq from New Brunswick, and she said, very passionately talking about the importance of species and from a spiritual perspective, and many things that I simply couldn't express but wanted to. And she said, we tend to make decisions that today and how they're going to affect us 7 generations from now. I thought, 7 generations from now. It's really quite extraordinary that a group of people could say that, feel that, believe that, and whereas most of us in society, we can't get beyond the next 24 hours or 48 hours. We seem to be generally incapable of looking very far down the road at all. So a very quick example of one thing one can learn.
If I may quickly respond, First Nations will be silent because governments are destroying the knowledge that they reveal. This is what First Nations have told me. We don't want to talk about our fisheries because every time we do, government can destroy it.
Anybody else at the back?
Yes, Jeff, you compared the American fishery legislation to the Canada Fisheries Act. You used the existing Fisheries Act. In 2007-2008, the Harper government tried to introduce a new Fisheries Act. Have you looked at that, and is that a great improvement?
You know, I actually, I haven't. I've looked at that quickly from other perspectives, and I wanted to look at it more recently, but I couldn't get a hold of it. To be quite honest, not to say that one isn't publicly available, it might be. The short answer is I haven't looked at it. I don't think it includes more prescriptive legislative tools for rebuilding fisheries, but I could be wrong.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your excellent presentation and for Dr. Daniel Pauly as well. We don't need just more organized NGOs. We need a more organized populace and more outspoken scientists like yourselves, because we need to rally the people around to save our oceans and to save our fisheries. So I've caught a couple of things. There was an article, I'm not sure if you saw it, by Mark Hume, who said what we gave some ideas about how we might save our salmon fishery, and that would be to stop fishing for some period of time so that the stocks would have a chance to rebuild. And I think it's something that we really do need to think about. And that's one. And the whole issue of having a wild salmon policy but no real implementation plan is another, when you talk about limit and target reference points. We need to get moving on that, and we aren't moving nearly fast enough, and there's absolutely no budget to do it in any meaningful manner. So it's nice to have the policy, but without an implementation plan, it's not very useful. But my question really, because of your expertise on Kosiwik and Sarah, is that we've worked very hard to try and get Upper Fraser Coho, Cultus and Saginaw, sockeye populations listed under Sarah. They were listed under Kosiwik, and it appears to me, and you also said it, that DFO just is there to block the listing of any commercial fish species. And that's certainly been our experience. Is SARA useful at all?
Yeah, no, I think that's. I do think it is useful, and I think in the broad sense, one way in which I tend to think about this is whether we're incrementally better off by having SARA than by not having it. And we'll take it from the marine conservation perspective. In the absence of SARA, would we be worse off? I think we would be. I mean, SARA has resulted in a variety, even if things don't get legally listed. I will say, and I've seen this on Kasiwik, that it doesn't necessarily take a legal listing at the national level to invoke important conservation measures at the provincial or territorial level. So that's been a good thing. I think with respect to fisheries and oceans, we tend to think of it as a monolithic entity, and of course it isn't. And I'll be the first to acknowledge there's various elements in DFO. There's science, there's policy, there's management. There's people have been there a short time, people have been there a very long time, and with all the strengths and weaknesses that that entails. I think with respect to SARA, I can tell you, based on my experiences, that there's a large contingent within the department that would like to see SARA employed to a far greater degree than it has been to date. It might take a new minister. In fact, one thing I didn't say in my talk, but I'll take the opportunity to say now, is that I think there's considerable merit, and the Prime Minister now has a cabinet to put together. There's merit in having a fisheries minister from Ontario, from Manitoba, from Saskatchewan. A minister with such large discretionary powers, to greater or lesser degrees, is going to be influenced by all sorts of interest groups, for better or worse. And I've sometimes have thought that ministers of fisheries and oceans must enjoy the discretionary power, and this is something that they would want to have persist. And someone said to me last week of a former minister of fisheries and oceans who told him that, in fact, he wished he had less discretion, because every time there's a decision to be made, there's so many people pounding at the door that it makes it very difficult to make a defensible and decision that he or she might like to have. So the discretion actually was a hindrance. So in the broad sense, I think SARA is a good thing. It's something to work towards. And again, it's only been 5 years. There'll be presumably a parliamentary review is supposed to begin any time now. And maybe with SARA, it's something that we look as something that benefits us 10 or 20 years from its implementation or its passage than the first 5 years.
My name is Gordon Slade, and I'd like to ask Dr. Hutchings a question about governance. We used to have the Fisheries Research Board of Canada, which I thought, in my experience, was more independent. The scientists were more independent than they are today, where they're sort of buried within the whole DFO organization. And what would you think of the idea that we brought back the Fisheries Research Board of Canada as a sort of an independent body that reported to Parliament and gave its advice on what should happen from the science side, not just to the minister, but to Parliament?
Thank you, Gordon. I think that this is indeed something that I wrote about 10 years ago, and I think I've always felt that there is merit in having advice provided by independent arm's-length bodies. It's one of the merits that I see in Kasiwik. In the Canadian context, I think that from a science perspective, things are more transparent and open today than they were 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I think there's no question about that in some areas, but not in all areas. With respect, for example, in species at risk, is the Canadian public party to what the scientific advice is on a listing decision? No, we're not. Should we? I suspect we ought to be. For the sake of accountability, transparency, and all these things that those who govern us wish to convey to us. I also think that there is indeed merit in having scientific advice provided from the broad context. Within fisheries and oceans, it tends to be on a species-by-species basis. There's clearly merit in talking about other things. Jamie mentioned that there are other stressors involved and that management, human-induced management, can't do it all. And having a regular means by which science in the broad scheme of things can be conveyed in a regular manner to government would be very advantageous. The downside is, as it's not quite clear to me how one does that in the absence of legislation. We have all sorts of independent bodies, well-meaning, put in an incredible amount of time, expert panels, royal commissions, and so on. I even think of some of the work by the Minister for Sustainable Development. And a lot of this stuff seems to get buried. It doesn't seem to be well advertised and well known. So the degree to which a lot of the good work that's being done in an independent sense is actually contributing meaningfully to public policy is a tough one to answer. I think there's considerable merit in doing it, but providing an effective means of doing that, I think, is perhaps more of a challenge than I might have initially thought.
My name's Don McKinley. Thanks very much, Jeff, for a really nice synopsis of the issues around some of the issues around oceans. I think you covered the overexploitation very well and came up with some quite constructive suggestions on how we might be able to better approach things in the future. I think you got off a little easy on the climate change part, though. As you know, I'm a stock enhancement kind of guy, and I like to be able to do something about, you know, problems. And I'm just not clear what we can do about, you know, is the ocean that we're, if we use proscriptive approaches, is the ocean we're preparing for an ocean of the past and not the ocean of the future? And how do we prepare for the ocean of the future? Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, I think in the general sense, it does remind me of, again, something that Jamie mentioned, that we have managed, typically, in the past, as if the environment is a static unit. It doesn't change at all. And yet, clearly, it does change. It changes regularly. People say to me, you know, why did Northern Cod collapse? Was it fishing? Was it the environment? You know, some people say the environment changed. And my response is, of course, the environment always changes. And what we have not been doing effectively is managing within that backdrop of regular, sometimes unpredictable environmental variability. How do we incorporate that? We do it through caution. We tend to stretch everything to our models. Maximum sustainable yields is one example. We stretch ourselves to the ideal situations, to the static environment and situations, instead of saying, you know, instead of managing at MSY or FO.1, we should step back. We should cut our fishing mortality levels to much less than that. That means some years we're going to let fish go. We're going to not take as many fish as perhaps we could have. But it's going to be sort of money in the bank for those times when things run dry. So my feeling is, at the end of the day, that that's simply an argument for caution and cautionary management, and something we haven't displayed enough of, and risk management, indeed, in our fisheries.
My name is Anna. Thanks for your talk. I have just a really quick, short question. Maybe related to that a little bit. If you say the implementation, or actually that the EU, European Union, and also New Zealand and another country has actually put those threshold on biomass and mortality rates. Is there implementation, and how do they do that?
Well, I should, clarify, the EU doesn't use them. It's the Scientific Council that has established and estimated these reference points. So when the scientists responsible for providing advice within the EU, when they provide that advice, they provide it in the form of saying, here are our reference points, and here's how close and how far we are away, and here's what our recommendation is. One classic example is one of 3 or 4 years ago, where scientists from the UK said, look, the cod in the North Sea are at such a low level, our recommendation is zero catch, no bycatch. Not just no directed catch, but no bycatch. But then that advice goes to the ministers within the EU, and the end result was, well, we'll have a fishery anyway. So within the EU, then, the scientists that provide the advice, they calculate the reference points, and even if there are deficiencies in the degree to which that scientific advice is heeded, at least society is well aware and can judge the politicians at some point of the degree to which their management actions are cautionary or risky, because they do know at least what the scientists have suggested are the risky and cautious areas to avoid or to be in.
So how does legislation actually get changed? Is there someone in this room that can write a new bill to send to someone? Or like, how does it actually happen, practically?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask, but I think ultimately I come back to this leadership element, and I think there's kind of two ways in which these things come about. One is through persistent and very strong public pressure across the board. And it's not clear to me whether that's going to happen. In fact, it seems to me it's not going to happen. The other way is from above. I mean, we have a seatbelt legislation throughout the country in every province and territory, not because there was public demand for it, but because governments felt that there was a need for such legislation. It could come from above. I mean, one question I've asked people in the States is I found it fascinating that they should have passed such prescriptive legislation in the U.S. of all places. And one of the most interesting responses I've had is that it gets rid of litigation. Everyone was sick and tired of litigation. And the extreme degree to which litigation was preventing anything effective happening, either for industry or for conservation or for government. And that was one of the reasons I've been told a couple of times as to why that legislation took place. But again, that was, you know, I guess partly from above and partly from below.
Are you above? Are you part of the above?
I don't think so, no. I don't think many people would consider me there, no.
We'll take two more questions. Dr. Hutchings, as you said, was in Halifax 24 hours ago, so he's on a somewhat different time scale to the rest of us. I had the gentleman on the right there and then the gentleman in front of me here.
Yeah, thank you. My name's Colin Campbell. I'd like to propose that fisheries management, in a way, is the wrong model. The only thing we can manage, really, is our own behavior. And when we think we're managing a fishery, the proper context, really, is how we're managing the ocean. And this is a convoluted way of asking a question about the ecosystem-based management's approach when we think more systematically about what's going on. Most prawn fisheries are carried out without any consideration of the natural predators of prawns in the ocean and the effects on them. So I wonder if in what you've said and what you're thinking and what you see, you see any possibility for that more comprehensive kind of management context, really, or protocol.
Well, certainly the moniker of ecosystem-based management is something that's been around for a while now, at least verbally propositioned and proposed, and a wish to have it more operationally defined has been there for certainly 10 or 15 years. The stumbling block, people constantly get stuck with how one defines it and how does one manage the ecosystem. I think operationally, one thing of a positive nature that has happened is that if we think that there is merit in having management policies that do their best to protect the interactions that take place among species and so on, is to reduce bycatch, reduce incidental catch. Do what it takes to reduce the likelihood that you're going to catch non-targeted species. To some degree, that's helped. I mean, the prawn fishery off Newfoundland has something called the Nordmoor Grate, which is meant to allow things such as cod, which, of course, the shrimp trawls catch in numerous abundance, to escape and to be able to leave the trawl. So I think it's certainly a goal that almost every fisheries management agency would say they're trying to achieve. But operationally, it's proved very, very difficult. But I think, frankly, that two things, reducing incidental catch and lowering fishing mortality, will probably end up, at the end of the day, achieving the ecosystem benefits that we want from ecosystem-based management. And I guess if there's one message to leave you with is, the one point that I've been sort of trying to make is, we are in this realm of dealing with ecosystems and species interactions, and rightfully so. But if we can't get what I would see to be the most simplest and most direct thing correct, then maybe there's not a lot of utility in talking about everything else. If we're unable to control fishing mortality and we're unable to articulate appropriate rebuilding plans for stocks that are clearly depleted, it's not clear to me that we have the gumption or the wherewithal to deal with many of these other things.
Final question.
I don't quite have a question, more a comment, but particularly kind of relates to the theme that's gone through this evening about what could we do. The question of how do we make legislation, there's two options. Convince your MP that they put in an act, that they actually put a bill in Parliament, or you write one and ask them to put it in for yourself. It's called a private member's bill. It seems as though our legislators actually don't listen to the people who it's their job to actually advise them on certain issues. My suggestion, and I think from what was spoken to earlier, is that this is clearly an issue that we all need to take into account really seriously as Canadians and take our civic duty and get as involved as possible to make sure that the people who are actually making these decisions at the highest levels in the country are actually doing them in our own good interest. Basically, you do that by making sure that you get behind somebody in the next election and help them get elected if you think that they are a good person who's going to make these differences. Now the election's passed, so we need to actually lobby, as was suggested, getting involved in NGOs. There are many. I work for one in particular. And there's an organization or a campaign called Get Your Vote On, period, nonpartisan. Get out and vote. If there's any way that we're going to make these changes that we're discussing here, it is to get involved in the political spectrum. The science is clear, it seems. Very, very clear. It's a matter that there's inaction at our highest levels of decision-making. So if there's anything that the question would be, I guess I can't really ask you to be partisan, but I would like to know, like, who should we be looking at? Who are up-and-coming individuals within federal, provincial politics that we should be encouraged to get in and actually start making these decisions for us so that we can actually have a secure future?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask, but I will give you my personal opinion very briefly, and that is, and I don't think I'm alone in this country, I think we were kind of looking for, I come back to that horrifically overused term, but it's actually a meaningful term, and it is leadership. It's somebody who's willing to voice a perspective and an opinion, and it's okay if they're not there 4 years from now. It'd be nice to see somebody have the determination and the courage to say, here's what I believe, and articulate it very clearly and very well, but not with the mindset that, you know, I do want to be reelected and so on. I do think, though, it's also probably rather difficult in many respects because I think probably being a leader of a party is probably a fairly thankless task. You've got so many other competing interests with people who might not share your view whatsoever. So it must be tough to sort of rise above that even internally, let alone finding somebody who's willing to do it externally.
I think the range of questions and comments we've heard tonight reflect the complexity of the topic and the competence of the speaker. Let me just say I would have loved to have pursued the archaeological data in more detail, as that's my own field. But to hear the range of questions that were generated tonight, I think is probably the best tribute we can give to the quality and importance of the lecture. So on behalf of the university, I'd like to first of all thank Patricia Gallagher and Gordon Slade for their overall sponsorship and organization of the event tonight. I'd like to thank the audience for coming, and I would like to thank our two responders who provided two quite different perspectives on what we'd heard tonight. I have actually a small gift for each of the responders and for Jeff, but first of all, I'd just like to congratulate and thank Jeff for the excellent job he did today. Thank you.
That concludes the question and answer period for the Canada Oceans Lecture 2008, delivered by Dr. Jeff Hutchings of Dalhousie University. It was at the WASC Center in Vancouver on October 22, 2008. The event was coordinated by Simon Fraser University.